Thank you very much, Judith, for organizing this very interesting talk in this great venue. How appropriate. Now, my talk is going to be mostly clinical material. I believe that the theoretical flows out of the clinical. So I want to describe to you in some detail an experience that I had with a patient who was, for the most part, silent throughout the analysis. And it was not a verbal type of analysis. Nevertheless, I believe it was probably one of my most successful analyses. So, oops. Okay. But I want to start with a brief introduction.
Louder.
I'll start with a brief introduction. Okay. A paradigm shift in analytic technique occurred with the publication by Ferenczi and Rank in, well, years vary. In English, it was 1925. In German, I think it was 1924. And the publication of The Development of Psychoanalysis, largely written by Ferenczi, where he suggests that it is the reliving of early Oedipal experience with the analyst that has more significant therapeutic impact than insight into the situation. The focus of analytic work was shifted onto the therapeutic relationship and repetition of early environmental trauma experienced in the transference. Ferenczi further elaborated on the importance of countertransference analysis in the clinical diary. Countertransference analysis facilitates working through of the negative therapeutic reactions, which are experienced as re-traumatization in the analytic space, a return of past repressed traumas in early object relations. The repetition of past trauma in the analytic situation occurs with a different and hopefully more benign and receptive object, providing the opportunity for a new beginning and the possibility of healing the scars of traumas inflicted on early development. Countertransference analysis and analysis of enactments in the analytic process is an important aspect of contemporary psychoanalytic technique. Yet there are a few examples of clinical discussion in the literature revolving around the actual experience of the countertransference, its analysis, and utility of ensuing insights in working through repressed early trauma experienced and re-experienced in the analytic space by both analyzand and analyst. Some notable exceptions are Searles, Ogden, Jacobs, Borgogno, but also Casement, Sandler, King, Ogden, Borgogno wrote on role responsiveness and role reversal. Casement and Sandler referred to subtle pressure placed on the therapist to actualize object relations from the patient's early life. Ogden refers to the transference onslaught, pressuring the analyst to behave in accordance with the analyzand's projection. King, in effective response of the analyst to the patient's communication, suggests that at times in analysis, a role reversal occurs where the analyst identifies with the victim while the analyzand takes on the role of the aggressor. Borgogno suggests that the analyst at times plays out different roles, the traumatizing object, traumatized self, and the repetition compulsion of early object relations in the long wave of the analysis. Ogden, an important paper, on aliveness and deadness, tracks his own associations and sessions in great detail to arrive at an understanding of aliveness and deadness experiences with his patients. His self-analysis led to insights into unconscious fantasy in his patients. He argues that associations to the patient's associations, daydreams and fantasies, are third space experiences shared and created by both analyst and analyzand. Thus, the analyst's experiences in analytic space are the outcome of the unique interweaving of analyzand and analyst's unconscious communications. Consequently, analysis of the analyst's experiences in the analytic space will reflect and illuminate the analyzand's experience. Jacobs outlines how analysis of his countertransference enactments led to insight into his patient's unconscious. And resolution of therapeutic impasses in the analysis, which were the result of the analyst inadvertently repeating early traumatic object relations in the transference and countertransference situation, which I'll call now the third space experience. But while Jacobs candidly described his own self-analysis and analysis of his enactments, it is still rare to read case material that introduces the analysis of the analyst's thoughts, feelings, and actions. Consequently, reported clinical data remains one-dimensional, the analyst's mental production. The addition of the analyst's self-analysis and the analysis of the interpsychic, which by that I mean the unconscious communication between analyst and analyst's end, these two modalities bring two more dimensions into the mix, making it a three-dimensional experience and more of a real-life theater. After all, is not analysis a replay of past repressed experience? The play takes place in the analytic space. In this sense, I endorse Shakespeare's assertion that all the world is a stage, and we but players on it. And there are two playwriters for the script, the analyst and the analyst. What follows is a script of Q and I. It may seem quite minimalist since most of the analysis occurred in silence, but my mind was not silent. The analysis started on a reluctant note. I was not keen on having Q as a patient. After an awkward phone contact and making an appointment to meet, I was left feeling that I was not going to offer him dynamic treatment. That was the request of his GP. I was planning to do the assessment and refer him out. My impression was confirmed at the first interview, which I conducted as a regular intake assessment. I was experiencing difficulty eliciting historical information, being faced with short monosyllabic responses, and periods of uncomfortable silence. I confronted Q using a dentist's office metaphor. I said, "I'm having difficulty getting information from you. It feels like we're in a dentist's office and I'm trying to extract teeth. It's a painful process." He started laughing. He said, "Cute, I don't like you. I don't like this process. And I don't like you playing with my mind. Did you read my file already? How did you know my father was a dentist?" "This is just like sitting in my father's office and see where my father." I think my jaw dropped when I said this. "Your father was a dentist? I remind you of your father?" You know, I was dumbfounded. I was put off by his frank expression of anger at me. I mean, he was kind of yelling this at me. But I was fascinated by my metaphor. I got it right. And his insight into the source of his irritation. But it got worse than that. He said, "No, you don't remind me of my father. You are my father." So my jaw dropped even further. I said, "What?" I said, "No, I'm not crazy. I know you're not my father. But being here in this office with you, I'm having very vivid memories of sessions I had with my father." Well, I said, "Okay, well, feeling the way you do, how could we proceed with therapy?" So I suggested maybe you could see somebody else or refer him somewhere else. So he said, "No, you don't understand. This is my last chance. I have no life. I can't leave the house because I'm afraid that somebody is inadvertently going to kill me. I'm like an ant on the sidewalk, and someone is just walking along and accidentally steps on me. I need to come here to make a change in myself. I can't go on like this. So as much as I don't like it, I need it. Now, you may decide that you can't treat me. That's up to you. And frankly, I wouldn't blame you if you thought you couldn't work with me." While he was saying this, what I was aware of, his gaze, it transfixed me. I couldn't not pay attention to him. I could not listen to him. It like penetrated me. So mesmerized, I heard myself say, "Okay, we can start next week." I said, "What did I just say?" Oh, no. Anyway. But I guess, I was feeling compassion for his suffering and that he was experienced. And yet, I was fascinated by his insight and this whole scene that evolved. And I wanted to hear more. but hearing more was long in coming. Now, I've made some poetical references to my experiences, which, if we have a chance later on, I'll mention them. But let me just say that Samuel Taylor Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner and T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Men and Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven were sources for me. Anyway, it was a dark, melancholic analysis, and I started reading this dark, melancholic stuff. It really depressed me. Yeah, but that was, I think, what we were going through. So I had pieced together the fragments of his story throughout the analysis, but I had not understood the essentials of his internal struggle until the end of the analysis. The agoraphobia had started immediately after a serious car accident, which he experienced as flashbacks. He was hit by another car. It wasn't the impact that he found traumatic, but the other driver's indifference to the fact that he had injured another person. This reminded him of experiences with his mother, when she would be indifferent to the hurt she caused to her children through her insensitivity. His mother had passed away 6 months before the accident. Growing up, he felt her to be emotionally empty and mentally absent, scarring her children who all had emotional problems. He once read a report on Mirsky's experiments with monkeys raised by surrogate inanimate wire monkeys. He imagined his experience with mother to be similar. He suspected that she might have a mild form of schizophrenia. His father had retreated to his dental office and was not involved in child rearing. He remembers interactions with father well. They would sit together in his office in agonizing silence. His experience with mother and father was repeated with me in the analysis, most of which was in complete silence. But the word silence does not do justice to the experience. Vast seas of emptiness, being frozen in time, blank non-being were more appropriate terms. I imagine that death must feel like those dread-filled sessions. Feeling uncomfortable in blackness, I would try to engage Q, asking what his thoughts were. He would say he didn't have any. I wonder what he thought about the silence. He couldn't think of anything to say. What was he experiencing in the silence? It's just like home. And at times he would cry when he said that. After about a year of this heaven of spirit, I decided to confront him about the silence. I asked him if he thought that having sessions in silence was okay. He asked me, "Is there a problem?" Surprised, I said, "Well, my conception of therapy was that it is a verbal process where he talks and I listen, and together we try to understand his inner world. So I wondered if there was any progress, or we stuck and we should try to get unstuck." He said that he didn't know how or why, but something was happening. He had no thoughts in the sessions, but was feeling the same feelings he experienced with his family growing up. He was beginning to be able to leave the house and reconnect with family. But was the silence a problem for me? "Well, if something was happening," I said, "then we should continue." In my mind, I thought, back to the dread and blankness. But after a few more years of this, I was ready to give up. The straw that broke the camel's back was a session where I had thought that I had dozed off and in a panic woke up believing that I had gone way over time. But barely a minute had gone by. I couldn't believe it. I stared at the clock, counting the seconds until the end of the session, 15 minutes later. Each minute seemed like an eternity. I thought, 15 minutes equaled 15 eternities. Like many other sessions, I was totally numb and empty at the end. I contemplated how many more eternities would I have to endure. The next session, I told him that I thought some other form of active therapy, like a day program, would be more appropriate for him. He asked, "Would you arrange that?" I agreed. While saying this, I flashed onto a scene he had described early in the therapy. One day, arriving home from school, his bags were packed along with an older brother's with a note and some money to rent an apartment. He had been coolly and cruelly cast out because his mother could no longer bear the burden of caring for them. So I started thinking, what was I thinking of? I examined my associations, my fantasies. There were verses that kept occurring over and over in my mind. Water, water everywhere, not a drop to drink. Alone, alone, all alone, on a wide, wide blue sea, from the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. So I went to read the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, which I'd read, I guess, about 20 years before. I don't know why those lines occurred to me, but they did. In the persons of the Ancient Mariner and the wedding guest, I recognized Q and myself. Transfixed by the mariner's gaze, the wedding guest had no choice but to hear his bizarre story. Despite several attempts to leave, he was paralyzed and unable to shake the mariner. The mariner was cursed for having inexplicably killed the albatross. Cursed, he and the crew were dead on the water in the dreadful doldrums, dying of dehydration. Water, water everywhere, not a drop to drink. A ghost ship approached with old hags on board, death and death in life. They were casting dice for the lives of the crew. Death had already won the lives of the crew, who dropped dead, looking accusingly at the mariner, one by one. But death in life had won the life of the mariner, who was cursed with having to live his life dead inside. He wandered the world, sharing his story with anyone he could waylay, and also sharing his burden of guilt with them. And at the end of the poem is memorable because the mariner walks away feeling light and relieved and good, and the wedding guest is heavy and burdened. And the last lines of the poem is, "A sadder but a wiser man was he on the morrow's morn." I realized that the real analysis was happening in our sharing his experience of deadness in the relationship with his mother, who was a mariner's death in life. I was able to symbolize my experience in the sessions, deadness. I became interested in this in literature. So I read Ogden's Enlivenance and Deadness, Green's Dead Mother, Rothstein's Papers on Nothingness. And they were all important readings that helped me to mentalize my unmentalized experience. After this realization, I decided to share my insight with him and told him that I had experienced intolerable feelings of deadness in the sessions. And that was the reason I suggested terminating. But perhaps this was a repetition of his being unceremoniously dumped by his parents at age 16. But now I thought that we should continue and work through this difficult impasse in therapy. As I was saying all this, he seemed stunned. And he said, "What word did you use? Deadness? You felt that? That's what I felt. I couldn't put my finger on it, but that was it." It all made sense now. We were both caught up in his unmentalized experience with his mother. I had both identified with Q and represented the dead mother. But I was also the child who survived the experience and symbolized it. I was a mother attempting to actively mentalize her child's experience. I was a father who sat agonizingly with him, but emotionally absent, and the son who longed for but despaired of father ever connecting with him. Also, I was a father who actively tried to shake the two of us out of the blank deadness we both experienced, and finally was able to symbolically represent our shared experience as deadness. After this exchange, the analysis continued, but with much less doom and gloom. He started to share with me his experiences in growing up, especially a sense of insignificance to his mother. There were many tears shed for the damage that people inadvertently inflict on each other, which remain as permanent scars and can't be undone. A little bit of a discussion. In the material I have presented, I made extensive use of my own reveries to arrive at insight into my patient's inner world. In arriving at the representation of our mutual experience of deadness in the third space, a transformation occurred whereby we were henceforth able to symbolically communicate the dread we both experienced of the deadness. A shift occurred from repetition of the past trauma in the analysis to reflecting on the trauma. It was after my comment about experiencing the deadness in the sessions that Q started to speak about his early life and relationships with his sibs. The fact that I had tried to reach out to him through our mutual experience of deadness marked the beginning of his venturing out of his retreat and testing the waters of human connectedness. He began to connect with the siblings and take an interest in their lives. He was no longer housebound, but had regular social outings with old friends and workmates. Conclusion. Analysis is like the story of Orpheus and Eurydice. They were lovers, but Eurydice had died and gone to the underworld. Orpheus charms Hades with his divine music, and Hades allows Orpheus to descend into the underworld and lead Eurydice back out. But on the condition that he not look back to see if Eurydice is following. At the last moment, when Orpheus has come out of Hades, he looks back at Eurydice, but she had not come out yet. She was still in Hades. And she disappears. There's no place for doubt in analysis, only trust and faith that the analytic process will do its work, whatever form it takes, and that it will move forward. It takes much courage for patients to face in therapy the repetition and reliving of the intense emotional traumas they experienced in early development. It was also an emotional challenge for the therapist who agrees to go through the mutual experience of the journey out of hell with his patient. One can only hope that Orpheus does not look back during the journey and that Eurydice is following. Thank you.
Thank you, Andre. I think that was a splendid clinical example of re-traumatization in potentiality. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion of it later in the thinking space. So thank you for that. Can I just ask you, are you cold? No. So that's fine. All right. Well, I'd like to introduce Etty Cohen now, who is a training and supervising analyst in New York at the Karen Horney Center for Psychoanalysis.
The American Institute for Psychoanalysis.
And
the White Institute.
And the White, Allenson White
yeah.
Institute. And author of a book called The Hard Life on Adolescence, Traumatized Adolescence. So, thank you.
The title of my paper is The Vicissitude of Enactments in Analysis of Traumatized Female Patients, Freud and Ferenczi to Contemporary Psychoanalysis. You hear me? Okay. The tears of doctor and of patient mingle in a sublimated communion, which perhaps finds its analogy only in the mother-child relationship. And this is the healing agent, which like a kind of glue, binds together from the diary. Ferenczi paid increasing attention to the way in which the transference, counter-transference, reenacted a patient's early life experience, not just as a fantasy in the patient's mind, but as an actual interaction relived between patient and analyst. The name enactment has only recently emerged as a technical one in psychoanalysis. However, as Aaron and Harris argue, Ferenczi's description of how we, he said, enter into a game with a patient was what has come to be known as enactment. Freudens forensic enactments, as well as their traumatized patients, are the focus of my presentation. Traumatized patients generally engage with us more through enactments than through words. These enactments take many forms, but seem basically intended to express unconsciously through action dissociated aspects of self and object representations. Dora, Freud's patients, and Chandon Ferenczi patients, DM and B, as he described in his clinical diary, were all traumatized. Let's start my presentation with Dora, Freud's patient. Dora is such a well-known case that I have chosen not to give details of her life, but will have a brief summary and will focus on the meanings and the evolution of enactment by Freud as well as by her. The Dora case, written in 1901, is the earliest masterpiece of psychoanalytic discovery, illustrating the use of dreams. A paper on psychoanalytic theory and technique, the Dora is a classic trauma case. Dora's family and propensity to sexualize emotional matters, to overemphasize her sexual aspect as father sexualized the relationship with 4K and possibly with Dora. Conversely, it failed to recognize what? Conversely, it failed to recognize sexuality where it was obvious, as in the case of the family's failure to intervene when Herr K sent flowers to Dora, or to confront the father and 4K's sleeping in obvious promiscuity. And disappearing into the woods together. The harm here is not carried out with a swiftness of a single trauma. This situation is more subtle. Dora didn't suffer from extreme states of dissociation or alternation in states of consciousness, but she did remain a propensity for depression and sadistic acting out that dominated her life and her relationships. Dora was 18 years old when Freud saw her for 3 months of analysis. There were 2 traumatic incidents with a family friend, Herr K, a kiss when she was 14, and a proposition at the side of a lake when she was 16. Dora was then already suffering from neurotic symptoms, migraine, a nervous cough, and hoarseness. In 1900, 9 months after the scene by the lake when Dora was 18, the family moved to Vienna. By this time, she tended to lose her voice completely from a nervous cough. When Dora left a suicide note saying she could no longer endure her life and subsequently had the first attack of loss of consciousness after an argument with her father, he brought her for treatment. She underwent analytic treatment with Freud from October to December 1900. Freud wrote up the case history in January 1901 after she left treatment, but saw her again for a single visit in 1902. In Freud's view, Dora had acted out part of her recollection and fantasies instead of remembering them in words. Acting out, and I don't have time to really explain the comparison between acting out and enactment, and I hope through my presentation, it will get clear. Acting out was originally seen as a resistance to treatment. The conceptual model on which such ideas were based lay in Freud's trauma theory, which emphasized the compulsion to repeat, supplanting the impulse to remember, particularly when aggressive feelings predominate. Freud later came to understand that he might have safeguarded the treatment with Dora if he could have linked her feelings for him in the analysis to the earlier version pertaining to her K and her father. With the hindsight, the 2 Dora's famous dreams signal her fear of being traumatized in the relationship with Freud. Jules Glenn believed that Freud's premature interpretation of Dora's symptomatic acts and their masturbatory significance must have convinced her that he was a dangerous sexual adult trying to seduce her. On the third of 3 days that were spent analyzing the second dream, Dora announced that 2 weeks previously she decided to terminate the analysis on that very day. When Dora returned 15 months later, Freud determined, quote, the glands after one glance of her face that she was not in earnest for her request. It's not after 15 months. So that's what I was stuck. That she was not in earnest for her request further help at the end of single session. Freud, quote, promised to forgive her for having deprived me of the satisfaction of affording her a far more radical cure of her troubles. Freud's inactivity when Dora decided to have analysis and his hasty and premature judgment that Dora was insincere in her request to resume treatment suggests the existence of countertransference enactment. Although he doesn't really spell out his conscious reasons for not resuming treatment, it would appear that he felt analysis had not been and could not be successful due to several factors. Dora had transferred her wish for revenge against her K and her father to him, and deprived and would continue to deprive Freud, quote, of the satisfaction of affording her a far more radical cure for her months, for troubles. As Freud mentioned, Dora had decided to halt her treatment 2 weeks before telling him. So, as Freud said, that sounds like a maid servant or a governess, a forthcoming warning. Glenn argues that Dora had identified with the servant who loved her father and the one who loved her Kay. Through displacement as her transference enactment, she became the governess who loved and left the seductive Freud who rejected her. As Freud said in the postscript, I ought to have said to her, it is from her K that you have made the transference onto me. Have you noticed anything that leads you to suspect me of evil intention similar to her K's? Glenn suggests that when Dora identified with a servant, a governess, a caretaker of children, this particular transference manifestation evoked Freud's countertransference enactment. He unconsciously recalled the nursemaid who had cared for him, seduced him, threatened him with punishment, and left him. Glenn writes that Freud reacted to Dora as if she were that maid. He treated her like a maid when he told her she was free to stop at any time, but that day they would go on with their work. Dora acted out an essential part of her interaction and fantasies instead of reproducing it in treatment. And Freud's unawareness of Dora's transference relating to her dreams and during her last session suggests of his countertransference enactment of letting her live. Moving to contemporary psychoanalysis, Rennick identifies 3 stages formulation of enactment in the therapeutic process. 1, through engaging in countertransference reenactments, Rennick believes the analyst enters the patient's relational world. 2, then after the enactments emerge, the analyst hopefully becomes aware of the transference-countertransfer feelings. And finally, 3, the analyst interprets, with the patient what has occurred between, with the hope that this will lead to insight and change. Being aware of the transference enactment only after Dora left treatment, Freud didn't have a chance to make the interpretations of what occurred between them. And after the analysis, Freud wrote, I did not succeed in mastering the transference in good time. At the beginning, it was clear that I was replacing her father in her imagination, which was not unlikely in view of the difference between our ages. She was even constantly comparing me with him. She constantly comparing me with him consciously and kept anxiously trying to make sure whether I was being quite straightforward with her, for her father always preferred secrecy and roundabout ways. But when the first dream came, in which she gave herself the warning that she had better leave my treatment, just as she had formerly left her K's house, I ought to have listened to the warning myself. Now, I ought to have said to her, it is from her K that you have made a transference onto me. And when this transference had been cleared up, the analysis would have obtained access to new memories dealing probably with actual events. But I was deaf to this first note warning. In this way, the transference took me unaware, and because of the unknown quantity in me, which reminded Dora of her K, she took her revenge on me as she wanted to take her revenge on him and deserted me as she believed herself to have been deceived and deserted by him. Here we can see that Freud had all the information that indicated Dora's transference that may have led to her termination. Why did he miss it during Dora's analysis? There are different views of psychoanalyst interpretations of Freud's counter-transference feeling during his analysis with Dora. A few of them I discussed earlier. Following Renick's formulation, if Freud were able freely to engage in the enactment with Dora, he probably could have disengaged sufficiently to observe and to be aware of the transference, counter-transference feelings of both of them. Freud kept asking himself what he could have done differently for Dora's analysis to be more successful. He wrote, if I had shown a warm personal interest in her, a course which even after allowing for my position as a physician would have tantamount to providing her with substitute for the affection she longed for, I do not know. Ferenczi had a different view of understanding. Lou Aaron believes that Ferenczi came to view the analyst's remoteness, distance, and lack of involvement as one reenactment of the original trauma. In his clinical diary, Ferenczi discussed his clinical work with severely traumatized patients. I will focus only on two, D, M, and B, and will stir up interesting questions. The case of DM. DM has identified by Dr. Judith Dupont to be Clara Thompson, Ferencian analysant, who became one of the founders of the Interpersonal School of Psychoanalysis. DM was mentioned in the diary as a victim of sexual abuse. Ferenczi wrote in his diary, as a child, DM had been grossly abused sexually by her father, who was out of control. Later, obviously, because of the father's bad conscience and social anxiety, he reviled her, so to speak. The daughter had to take revenge on her father indirectly by failing in her own life. DM had developed some serious psychological symptoms as a result of her childhood trauma. She had the somatic delusions that she smelled like a corpse, DM felt that she had sexual odor. Ferenczi talked about being accepting of DM's order and not being repelled by it. Ferenczi wrote, naturally, this provoked reactions of disgust in the analyst, which had to be overcome in the course of a prolonged period of work. DM worked intensely with Ferenczi from 1931 until his death in 1933. She tested the boundaries repeatedly, moving from resistant distancing to sexualized affection to humiliating disclosure and distortion of her analyst behavior and frequent acting out of her transference through triangulations with his other patients. Could envy or competition have contributed to her more drastic efforts to get Ferenczi's attention? From the diary, we learned that Ferenczi and Adler noted DM's strange odor, which Ferenczi felt came from unexpressed rage. In Ferenczi's care, DM was able to become increasingly open and direct with him, with her feelings, and lost her offensive somatic symptom. DM's sexual abuse by her father was reenacted with Ferenczi. She acted out in the session by kissing Ferenczi and then bragging about it to other analysts and colleagues. DM permitted herself to such physical expressiveness in the face of Ferenczi's passivity that she repeatedly kissed him without his resisting. Ferenczi's letting DM kiss him might provide a relief from her past traumatic experience with her father, with whom she had the opposite role of staying passive while her father sexually abused her. In this matter, Dr. Axel Hofer raised two main questions. Does the analyst, by accepting to the demand, provide a corrective emotional experience which often precludes a genuine resolution of the affects originating in the traumatic event? Or, by not acceding to the expressed need, does the analyst anti-therapeutically re-traumatize the patient? Both Bellint and Winnicott believe that at certain times, touching can be therapeutic during periods of deep regression, but they acknowledge that touching might be highly sexualized, might be sexually charged, or reflect the analyst enactment. The kissing incident raised several questions. Did Ferenczi, by accepting DM's kisses despite her bad smell, enable her to express her negative transference, even though he knew that she could harm him reputation, harm his reputation? Did Ferenczi consider DM fragility and make a conscious decision not to reject her? Knowing Chusett's view, DM's behavior during the session was her acting out and was not an actment. And that's what I thought, but I think after the Emmanuel lecture yesterday, we may consider also a possibility that there was an actment, considering that she was part of the group and the dynamic among her friends and how Ferenczi react to her when he knew that they are all together sharing the information. So I thought about it as an actment, but you can see it also as I saw it as an acting out, but you can consider it as an enactment. Depends how you make the interpretation of this. Okay. Okay, so Ferenczi see action as potent. So I'll move to discuss BI. I have some literature about other people that spoke about action versus verbal expression. So I'll move to talk about the case of B. Okay, so B. Ferenczi patient was a psychotic woman who had been raped. And I'll read part of it, and I don't know if you are, all of you kind of familiar with B, with the patient B. So maybe I'll read it really a brief of the summary. Okay. So I think I'll summarize that B was a patient that was a raped and had sexual hallucination, and there were a few incidents with Freud, with Ferenczi, and one I only will discuss one. There were a few, but I'll discuss only about one. Okay, so I only discussed the dream. She had a dream of the robust man with a small penis. Ferenczi understood this to be transference dream, and was able to satisfy her curiosity by sharing with her his own anxiety about his small penis. B said to Ferenczi that as he had been open with her about his weakness, she would not hurt him by commenting on his weakness as she had before. Now, instead of focusing on Ferenczi's weakness, she was more ready to deal with her own struggles. Ferenczi wrote that this disclosure led B to realize that it was not unsatisfied sexual hunger that had led her to abdominal pain, nor the withdrawal of love he had experienced during her childhood, but the rape that had occurred during her childhood. So after he disclosed about his small penis, he was saying that she was more in touch with her being raped. And this was the source of the abdominal pain. Ferenczi understood her abdominal pain as a relieving of the pain of the rape. I'll pass. When Ferenczi disclosed carefully thought through, or was it an enactment? Was he reacting emotionally? Was it best to respond immediately and spontaneously, as he evidently did, and only later to analyze? From Ferenczi's report, a significant shift occurred with B. His reaction uncovered her dissociated experience of rape. This was a risk that Ferenczi took that could have ended up a disaster. Ferenczi's disclosure could have closed the potential space between them. Moreover, do we know the long-term effect of this interaction? How did B feel about Ferenczi's penis complex? Did she feel sorry for him and therefore try to compensate him by opening herself up? Did his disclosure concretize what ought to have remained symbolic? Did Ferenczi's self-disclosure, because he had a solid therapeutic alliance with B? So, having written that the complex of the small penis, quote, is common struggle among neurotics and far from rare among the healthy, Ferenczi might have rationalized his disclosure by explaining that it was not any great significance to disclose this to his patient. Although not knowing about Ferenczi's sexual life, we can assume that this perception of his penis of his penis as small was a charged issue for him. Thus, I believe that Ferenczi went too far with his self-disclosure to B, and that disclosure with B can be considered counter-transference enactment. Okay, I will summarize. In summary, Freud and Ferenczi chose different paths in working with their patients. Freud chose not to disclose his counter-transference enactment to his patient, Dora, or was unconscious of it. While Ferenczi observed and was aware of DM acting out behavior in her transference, he was emerging mutual enactment with his patient, B. Although there were situations with her that his disclosure might have deteriorated to boundary violation, he chose to experiment with disclosing his counter-transference enactment and their origins. This process may have created a corrective emotional experience that necessitated, at times, a secure therapeutic experience. I would like to close my presentation with Dr. Judith Dupont's statement from the Ferenczi diary. The diary is clinical diary. It recounts the clinical history of many of Ferenczi patients, but also Ferenczi himself. In other words, it offers a history of the multiple transference and counter-transferences that intertwine in an analytic practice reported with unusual candor. Ferenczi dares to hear and dares to express feelings. ideas, intuitions, and sensations that generally have great difficulty working their way to consciousness and even greater difficulty allowing themselves to be formulated in words. Thank you.
Thank you, Etty. That was a very interesting paper, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion. I'm inviting Franco Borgogno to come to the podium now. He's a training analyst with the Italian Psychoanalytic Society and a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Turin.
Okay. Before starting, I would like to thank Judith, Tom, Stefan, Ivan, and all the others who worked a lot for our being here now. I will limit my presentation to just 2 points, which regard the conditions that have to be met for the analytic process to be really analytical, in accordance with Ferenczi's conception of analysis. The first concerns the fact that analysts, like their patient, come from afar. The second, closely linked to the first, concerns the fact that if analysts are to truly understand their patients, they must first take on their suffering, in such a way as to become the patient, since psychoanalytic knowledge for Ferenczi is not intellectual but visceral. Its intellectual aspect, that which comes to effectively know something about the patient and is not therefore a purely defensive form of knowledge, is a much later product for Ferenczi, the product of a long transformation at the basis of which lies the complex and long working through of what the analyst has embraced in his gut over the course of an analysis and therefore has embraced in his heart and has allowed to remain within himself until such a time as its deepest meaning arises. One consequence of this is that for Ferenczi the transformation of the patient come to depend unequivocally on the willingness of the analyst to allow himself to be the first to be transformed in and by the psychoanalytic process. From here emerge in Ferenczi view our possibility of bringing assistance to another mind. Before delving deeper into this matter, I wish to underline that the working through is not just a distinctive feature of Freud and Melanie Klein, but also of Ferenczi. The clinical diary approached from this angle is without any doubt a ceaseless exploration of the intense and complicated psychical work which awaits analysts to undertake to penetrate the heart of suffering of the patient and to find to the close examination of the intricate dynamic of transference and counter-transference in the analytical relationship, those interpretations through which he may authentically be reached. Coming from afar, about my first point, which I have referred to as coming from afar, I would immediately reiterate that in Ferenczi view, not only the patient, but also the analyst comes from afar, since both patient and analyst have been babies, children, teenagers and subsequently young adults. The analyst too has been a patient and may indeed still be one when he undertakes to assist another mind. How, Ferenc explicitly asks himself, is his 1927 the adaptation of the family to the child, can we meet another mind analytically if not by getting in tune with our own past as children who slowly and gradually grew up starting from our encounters with our parents and with those individuals, mentors, who took their place in later period of our lives, teachers, but also peers, those older or younger than us. How can we meet another mind if we don't recall our own experience as patients in relation to the various aspects of our own self and with the figure of the outside world, which with time have become internal figures? To this, we should also add our relation to our own analyst. In sum, how can we meet the patient, and this is the declaration we Ferenczi made to the psychoanalytic community in 1927 text, if not through recourse of our own experience of life in all its complexity, and in particular to how we ourselves have traversed the many forms of turbulence which characterize any life and growth processes, in particular during those neuralgic moments of passage which are common to all human beings, and to how those individuals predisposed to assist us have succeeded or not succeeded in doing so at those moments. To put it another way, for Ferenczi, to recall one's own infancy and childhood, it's precisely this: not to forget the great dreams and the great pain of those periods, bearing in mind, first and foremost, how many of the events experienced at those age are initially felt to be catastrophic, and only, but not always, come to appear physiological and ordinary with the passing of time, in dramatic contrast to our immediate sensation. This, we call this the fundamental tempering function of the analyst. So, for Ferenczi, not forgetting one's infancy and childhood, and here we come to the elasticity of the psychoanalytic technique, the paper which complements the thesis presented in the paper on which I am now commenting, implies that the analyst keeps holding on, tied to the other end of the elastic band to which the patient is clinging. The elastic band representing the thread of life, the shared destiny of humanity. That is to say, we must be willing to oscillate within this bond between one pole and the other, enriched and fortified not least by that perspectival vision gained from the reliving one's own experience through analysis, a perspective which the child and the patient in many cases are lacking or have lost. This is the vision which, precisely because we have worked through our own life events together with another mind better equipped and more solid than ours, can oppose the dark despair, pain and misery of the infant and adolescent psyche with such a degree of hope and encouragement that without denying the traumatic nature of many sentiments and life events can render mitigate their intensity from both a qualitative and quantitative point of view, thus rendering them more acceptable and bearable. Here lies Ferenczi's approach in the two papers which I am here discussing, an approach infused by commonality and recognition, which paves the way to that pietas which contrasts the many forms of terrorism of suffering often present also in the analyst's internal attitude toward the patient. Imaginative identification and perspectival vision consequently come to constitute for Ferenczi the principal characteristic of psychoanalytic understanding, which require, together with recognition of oneself in the other and of the other in oneself, a concomitant and indispensable act of credit on the analyst part, a act of credit directed not only towards the patient, but also toward oneself and one's own potential. Parents and analysts who recall their own childhood and adolescence and who have grown up with another person who recalls these periods are indeed conscious from personal experience of the fact that things evolve and of the moment in which it is necessary to give them time to do so. They have learned that the present is a past which has not yet been developed, and that the past is a future which has yet to be developed. And this knowledge has not left them impatient and intimidated by the fact that experience without thought and the thought without experience, which usually denote human childhood and adolescence, will repeat and represent themselves in the present time of the analytic encounter. So, conclude Ferenczi, the Ferenczi of this period, what can truly open the way for a new day, promoting growth, if not this basic faith in the transformative potential of every human being? In it is this faith, he explained, which enable us to glimpse a spark of that which even the smallest and poorest things may be and become in the future. From this very emotive position spring both the tact which Ferenczi defines as a cornerstone of the analytic process and the sympathy or Mitfühlung, feeling with, which from the clinical diary on served to make the analyst commitment real in the eyes of the patient. These two come to represent essential forerunners to the construction of that sense of trust and reliability which precedes the onset of a new beginning and a new development. And here we are at the second point. A point which Ferenczi outlined in the clinical diary in terms of temporarily becoming the patient. To this expression, we must, however, immediately add the specification without the analyst himself knowing it. Indeed, as Ferenczi demonstrated in the clinical diary, if on the one hand the analyst is necessarily constrained to become the patient every time it truly succeeds in his receptive openness to the other, in avoiding putting up a barrier between the other and himself. On the other, experience himself specifies it is only after the analyst has effectively become the other, allowing himself to be inhibited by the patient or to function as a psychic stomach, it's only then that he can authentically recover and assume his identity as analyst, in order to give back to the patient a part of his life which has been dissociated, in which has often not even been inscribed psychically, let alone verbally. Some passages from earlier writing which to my mind prefigure Ferenc Leiter's ideas. His affirmation in 1913 that first-hand experience lies at the basis of any psychoanalytic conviction, for feelings generates believing. His subsequent assertion in 1924, together with Frank, that psychoanalysis is founded on emotional and personal experience, and that this kind of experience is the peculiar and specific transformative factor of analysis, is having clarified in the same 1924 book that the analyst must inevitably assume all of the possible role that the patient unconscious demands to be re-equalized during the analysis. In 1924, Ferenc held these roles to correspond above all to the two parental images, father and mother, while in the clinical diary it would rather be the being immersed for a long time in the position of the child and of the adolescent within the adult patient, in the majority of cases of a child and adolescent traumatized and wounded, the principal role which the analyst must incarnate and embody, whether he likes it or not, even thought my God. Yes. Okay. My wish, even if the analyst might wish to avoid it at all cost. Prior to, and at the same time as this, Ferenczi also precise that the analyst, this is an important point, does not only represent the internal object of the patient, but he unfortunately becomes these objects, in particular the murderer and the sadistic aggressor of the patient. That very murderer and sadistic aggressor whom the child within the patient encountered in his infancy. Is having depicted in his later papers the analyst as an individual able to lay aside his personal identity and ego and therefore ready to assume an identity, a neurotic, a fool, a delinquent, a childish person, and to a greater extent as an individual who is willing to accept for weeks on end the role of an aunt Sally on whom the patient tries out all his aggressiveness and resentment, seeing that in accordance with the definition presented by Ferenczi in his 1928 Madrid paper, the analyst must function for the patient as an orphan man, such as those to be found in fairs in Vienna and Budapest, on which every passerby could vent his own unpleasant and painful feeling, receiving by way of response nothing more that the count of their strength. This calculus, as we know, is for Ference in 1926, an act of screening and of thinking on the part of the analyst who, in squaring up to the reality faced by the patient, temporarily suspends, modulates, and adapts his subsequent action and reaction in the patient regard, transforming it into something which may at a later moment and to the surprise of both parties prove useful to the failure of the analyst and the growth of the analytic couple. One offer the new aspect which find their first stammering expression in the clinical diary, I will here underline just three. Firstly, the analyst must fall sick with the same illness which is afflicting the patient and then recover in order to remobilize the patient's will to return to life and to rediscover within himself, I quote Ferenczi, the motifs it has something related to the future, end of quote. Then there is the notion of mutual analysis. However, while for Ferenczi this corresponds to becoming in turn both patient and analyst, nowadays this notion can be seen as that which precedes the analyst's subsequent capacity to sustain and work through in the course of the session and across the long wave of the analytic process, that role reversal, which is an indispensable step towards, I quote Ferenczi, the objectivization and representation. Always quoting Ferenczi, objectifying it as a something that happened to another person and can only be represented in this form. Objectivization and representation of those elements of the patient personality which have been scattered and lost, either because they have never been mirrored by the environment in which the patient has grown up or because the patient has been forced into dissociate existence when the self-sacrifice and the concomitant identification with a non-provident and traumatogenous adult have been the only available survival maneuver in a life characterized by excessive pain. Finally, the analyst should serve as a living witness to the not remember relational past of the patient, thereby paving the way for a reversibility of all psychic processes. Paradigm for the first of these aspects, which can essentially be summed up as the needs that every patient has to gauge whether the analyst is willing to know and touch the suffering which he is bearing, and should this happen, to see how the analyst approaches and manages it, see also beyond in this regard, is to be found in the description of the patient who wanted Ferenczi to become Julius Caesar and himself suffer from an epileptic seizure, so that his analyst may understand with body and mind the sense of agony and death struggle which he, the patient, felt every time he had such an attack, together with the associated sentiments of shame, humiliation, complete harmlessness, depression and deficit in his ability and desire to go on living. With regard to the second aspect, the mutual analysis to which Ferenczi attained has come to be viewed by many of us as an example of how we can arrive at the true understanding of the patient and of the psychic configuration which dominate his inner world and interpersonal relations. including the analytic relationship. In particular, his long and detailed analysis of R.N. Elizabeth Severn, which is described and to which he returns on several occasions in the clinical diary, has enabled us to see how the past and the intrapsychic life of the patient must repeatedly reemerge bit by bit as interpsychic events before they can provide access to that comprehension and interpretation which open a chance to rewrite one's own history and at the same time allows for a structural change. One can only have such a chance to rewrite one's own history and attend to a structural change, and herein lies Ferenczi's legacy, if the analyst gradually come to embody by personifying and therefore mentally distinguishing between the various characters who inhabit the patient's inner world and self. If the analyst gradually come to embody a living witness to the patient's psychic pain and to that from which it stems, and in so doing to release and rehabilitate the mystery and secret of another art by giving it a soul and a voice. On the basis of my 1994 paper on the girl who committed Karakiri, with Massimo Vignatalianti, I have sought to modify the classic Freudian sequence of the operation which render analysis a transformative experience in a manner very much influenced by the professional philosophy expressed in the clinical diary. Our proposed sequence is as follows: experiencing, making ourselves interpreters, repeating, working, reworking through and remembering, highlighting how making ourselves interpreters and unknowingly repeating are indispensable condition if we are to attain to an authentic working, reworking through and remembering, and hence to thought and interpretation. This is an element which Bonomi, in reflecting on Ferenczi's legacy to contemporary psychoanalysis in the wake of my treatment of the girl who committed Karakiri, clearly grasped when he argues that a truly transformative analytic experience should be, to Ferenczi's mind, viscerally corrective. It should be viscerally corrective both in as much as it always implicate the viscera or guts of the analyst, independently of whether this reflect a conscious plan on the analyst's part, and in as much as the reconstruction, construction, reparation process start out from and as its own at this level, that is, from the guts.
Thank you very much to Franco, to Etty, to Andre. And
I would like your paper.
Hopefully we can
I have sent to you
your comments and your questions.
Why did you send it?
It's a question for Etty about the Dora case. I wonder if you could comment on...
Tuesday or Wednesday.
I wonder if you could comment on the Dora case. My kind of understanding of it is that Freud was a family friend of Dora's father. And in your account of what happened between them, I didn't kind of hear you talk about, I mean, it seems that the transference was already sort of polluted before it even started, and that, of course, she was going to be seeing him as doing her father's bidding, because she was being difficult and she was sent off to Freud, the family friends, to sort of be dealt with, you know. So what are your thoughts on that?
I didn't really have time to cover all of this. There was an issue that she was a teenager, not teenager, but at this age that he completely wasn't as relating to this. It was a time that there wasn't as much theory on the meaning of working with adolescents. And it's true what you said. It was started before. The father was the one who brought her. This was even bigger issue. She was referred by her father. He knew the father. They really interact with each other after she terminate. And there are very kind of issues there is so much written that I'm sure you'll have much more to say, you know, but it's true what you said, that it was so much, but I think what was striking, that he was, all these kind of sentences was said and the dream and clues in the dream that he later was aware of it and he was saying it was so obviously it was going on, but still he didn't really make comments about her transference. He didn't say about himself why he didn't really recognize or why he wasn't aware the meaning that he didn't pick up the transference. He didn't really talk about. But maybe there are other analysts that said it was a time that these theories and this concept were not as established and but on the other hand, Ferenczi was also at his time. And I didn't have time to talk about the other example of B, that he really shared while he was in the session with her, he shared his counter transference. That while he was in session with her, he was aware of his counter transference and he shared. And they really work at the same time. So I don't know.
Thank you. I also want to say something about Etty's paper, and in particular the analysis of Clara Thompson. She draws out a question of, well, is this enactment or is this acting out? This is actually a profoundly more important thread, I think, because this was the moment of fracture between Freud and Ferenczi. And in Freud's very famous letter on kissing, which I think was 1931, he's already heard in Vienna, as many of you in this room know, about Clara Thompson having kissed Papa Ferenczi, and writes an exquisitely a beautiful letter to Ferenczi saying, let's leave morality aside. If you wish to kiss your patient, why not? Good on you. But please keep it to yourself. This, after all, is what they're doing in communist Russia, where everyone's kissing everybody else. But please, this has nothing to do with psychoanalysis and technique. Now, in the letters, normally, Ferenczi replies to Freud with alacrity the same day. There's a 2-week gap. And Ferenczi really doesn't address Freud's point. The question is, who is kissing who? If you have somebody, a patient who comes into the room and falls on you, kisses you, then this is a profound enactment. Harold Stewart's written in the same vein about a patient coming into the consulting room and grabbing his genitals. It's not that he offered his genitals to the patient fell on them and held them very tightly. And it was very difficult for him to get free. I think that for Ferenczi, he was really shocked that Freud didn't understand that he wasn't kissing the patient was kissing him. This was not a moment of mutuality, as I understand it, at all. And in fact, Ferenczi's reply comes 2 years later in his extraordinary paper on Confusion of Tongues, which I think, to my mind, is his reply to Freud's wonderful letter about who is kissing who. Thank you.
Was your point related? Is it, yes?
Not exactly on that note.
But, I mean, is it again to Etty, or is it all? No.
General.
Can you hold your answer for later? Yeah.
No, but if somebody wants.
No, then you go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted very shortly, because we're running out of time, but to pull the thread of that's going through the three presentations that we had this morning, I felt the thread of temporality. And unless I missed it, I don't think you're all talking about it, but you didn't mention the après-coup of the actual experience of analysis. And I think it's in all your papers there somewhere. The subtext, I'd say. The après-coup of a trauma that was silenced in the past. There's always a silence, especially when it's transgenerational, but I think there's always something of a disavowal that silences the real traumatic effect. So my feeling is that we don't, I differ a bit from you on that we don't relive the trauma, us and the patient, exactly as it was. The actual is something completely different from the present. I think the present advient, how do you say that in English, occurs, is the consequence of the representation. There I rejoin, I join what you were saying. So, yes, we work with our, and I agree totally with Franco, with our own experiencing as babies, as patients, as victims, and as murderers. And I think the fact that we first, what works against the disavowal is the fact that we represent it for ourselves first. Not self-disclosure, I don't go in that sense at all, but the fact that we could represent, that we could think the experience, helps something to become, to pass from actual to present, and then the past can be seen as, the present can be seen as different from the past, and open on a future that may be different. Okay, so it's just a thread of temporality that I felt that was going all through the three presentations. Thank you.
Yes, and I think the intrapsychic into the interpsychic as well. But thank you.
Thanks. Two related points. Is this mic on? Yeah? Is mic on? Yeah. Two related points. One is about unconscious communication within the consulting room. It seems to me that, you know, one of Freud, because it was later than the Dora case, comes up with the idea of the analyst as a receiving instrument in unconscious communication. What he doesn't have, and never, I think, is a sense of the communication going the other way, from the analyst to the patient, which is much inferency. And this, in a way, I think, is something that happened probably in the Dora case, that they unconsciously picked up that he was actually sexually rather charged. You know, in the letters to Fleece, he talks about opening her case with his picklock, and he knew jolly well what her reticule meant. It's in the case study. So that there's something very sexual in the counter-transference, which he didn't yet understand. You know, this way, years on, we understand more about it. So there's that one-wayness, I think, of the communication. I struck Andre's paper by the way that unconsciously, sort of heart of darkness, I mean, you know, we come up with our own. which are all texts about actually the repetition of cumulative trauma, which can't be heard. You know, there'll be another wedding guest. He has to go on and tell somebody else, another analyst or another somebody somewhere, if it can't be understood. And that what you manage to do unconsciously is to pick up the significance of that association, process it. But I think he knows that, actually, before it's actually said in the consulting, probably. So the atmosphere of what goes on is a communication the other way around, from the unconscious of the analyst to the unconscious of the patient, and that's part of the transformative effect.
I think you're right that he did sense something happening, in me at that point. And what was happening was that I became more alive. When I was able to come up with the concept of what's going on, I felt back again, alive. And I think he sensed that. And I think that was, that communication came through as well, as you were saying, that the patients pick up as well your communications. And I think that's what really changed things.
Louis Kirshner. So I thought there was a, related to that comment, a thread through all three papers, the big question of countertransference being used therapeutically and productively or leading to some kind of action that, that may do something somehow good or it may not, but it's not part of, a, of an analytic elaboration, it's, if you look at it that way. What's a useful way to use the countertransference? And I think Etta Cohen's paper brought out these two mistakes that are very interesting. Well, she views them as enactments. I wouldn't say, maybe in Freud and Ferenczi. And there was certitude on both their parts that what they felt about the patient was real. I think Ferenczi thought that the patient's dream definitely had to do with him. Maybe she read his mind of his worries because he did believe in telepathy or in the unconscious, and so did Freud for a while. And that's a dangerous position because it, rather than explore the charged material, there's a certitude about understanding it, which leads to an impasse so regularly. Whereas in André's case, he pays attention to his countertransference. He doesn't assume that he understands that this patient's going to hate him like he hated his father. This is a useless treatment. He took it as a sign of what was stirred up in him and over a long time tried to use it. I think that's a beautiful example. And maybe you benefited from having read and studied this stuff, you know, that there's something to do with it, not to, you know, let go a little bit of the analytic certitude.
I think one of the interesting things, apart from the pain and suffering of working with regressed patients, is that they make you really work and think. And I think this is how analysts tend to grow in therapy with their patients, is that they suffer with them and they want to find out what the suffering is about. And so, yes, I whether coincidentally or as a consequence, I went to read dark text that made me depressed by consequence. And yes, I grew out of the experience, and that's what's so interesting. Being an analyst, you know, you always have the possibility of growing.
Well, maybe I'll come back to what Mrs. said about the thread of time, and I wanted to ask a question. What, of course, he will not answer because it would be very long to Mr. Borgogno. When he said the analyst becomes the murderer, when Ferenczi says, of course, you quote, well, an actor in person, maybe we should come back to the ordinary thought that maybe you enact, we enact, father and mother, etc. But this is a little short, and I would say we are, in analysis, the craziest of all history. The craziest point, not only the craziest person, the craziest point of all history and genealogy. And this empty, discarded, or denied spot on the environment is what reacts mostly and secretly. For instance, an ignored baby, refused suicide, secondary marriage hidden, war traumas or treacheries, political or familial treacheries. We, the analysts, are thrown at that spot, at that point. And of course, this is an enormous solicitation to us to know where we are. In a far past, in a secondary line of the family, in now, in apparent, it might be sexual involvement, apparent sexual involvement is there, or in a near future where maybe the patient wishes we could be in order to be a good cradle for him in the future. But we are the craziest spot in the history. And this is just widening what happens in transference. And I wish that we could go on.
I will reply to you and also to Josette, perhaps, in a very general way. What we fear as analysts in Ferenczi view is not to be surely the good object, or also the bad object, the new thing in Ferenczi thought, and that we fear to be the infant self, the baby, the adolescence, because we forget our past. And I think this is the most important point in Ferenczi, which I on which I reflected in my book Psychoanalysis as a Journey, and much more in my last book on the girl who committed Karakiri. This is the part of the analytic work which we fear. Not so much to be the parents, but to be the infant without words and the infant with a so great pain. What I have cut in my paper is much more longer than for this presentation, but in my mind, the first point of it, and to attract the attention of the colleague, that we can start to learn much more about the function of the analyst, the many functions which are enlightened now by infant research, by infant psychoanalysis, but we can deepen on that level. And deepen that level is deepen, in my view, the point started from Ferenczi, but also from Paula Heimann. I linked Paula Heimann and Ferenczi. When Paula Heimann started try to understand what we say to a patient beyond the words, what are the metacommunicative messages, what function we are adapting in working with the patient. These two papers of Paula Heimann were for me fundamental. Paula Heimann comes to Italy in the 80s, at the end of her life. One paper was the paper of the function of the analyst, and the other of 75, of the cognitive functions of the analyst. A short paper, but in my view, very interesting. And before dying in Rome, she gave two papers not published by the English. I don't know why, because they were very simple. They have the translation. They delivered the paper in English, not in Italian. But they decided too difficult to translate the two papers. Too new the papers. She was very old and giving two very new papers. That's all.
Thank you, Franco.
I am interested in the APRQ, but I am more interested in the capacity of the analyst as a person who knows, who can transform the catastrophe in physiological. This is the function very important, to see a future in the drama of the patient in the pain. And I hope have transmitted this from my paper. Anyway, this is the subject of my paper.
Etty is going to respond as well, and we've just got a few minutes.
Okay. So I think in my paper I try to focus on three kind of examples. One is acting out, and I think there are a very meaningful a difference between acting out and enactment. The main difference is that in enactment, the analyst is observing. Even though he is engaged with the patient, he's not kind of participate in the interaction. While in enactment, there is some unconscious in terms of the analyst and the patient. And there is some unconscious process going on in terms of the interaction. So I think in terms of my presentation, I want to give three examples. One is about an acting out, and which, if we talk about Ferenczi, I thought about DM as example about acting out, that Ferenczi was aware about the kissing, what is the meaning about the kissing, why he wanted to engage with her with the kissing, but this is acting out. Now there are two more examples about B, with B. One example with B is that he wasn't aware about his countertransference and he wasn't acted and didn't even share. He rationalized and he didn't really share his countertransference. He wasn't aware probably. And the third example was that he was with B that I couldn't have time to really discuss. He really was aware about his countertransference while he was in session. And then he shared with her where it coming from in terms of his life and why he feels this way and why he reacted to her this way. So I think it's very meaningful to really understand the difference between acting out and enactment. It's not the same kind of process.
Thank you. Franca wants a very
short. No, and ask of help. I proposed to the International Journal to publish these two papers of Ivan delivered in Rome. With some little comment. I say this year because I hope that someone, because I never have a reply. I am a member of the board of the International Journal, but perhaps there is something in the dark room of the journal who can help this project to be realized. Because it is a pity for the English. Mostly, not to know these two simple, beautiful, deep papers.
Thank you. I just wanted to say to you that we've been invited to a light lunch, courtesy of Zara Restaurant, which is both Anatolian and Kurdish. And would you please be back here at 2:30?